Thank you very much. Thank you. And Les, thank you very much for all those things you said. You know, if I was as young as I'd like to pretend to be, you'd never had any problem. They call it social sciences now. But there were some things there you could have left out. For example, that reference to the honorary degree my alma mater gave me. I've nursed a feeling of guilt for a number of years that the first one they gave me was honorary. Then, on the other hand, you left out the best job I ever had in my life when you were talking about those earlier days, washing dishes in the girls' dormitory. But, yes, someone from really what is the hometown. I was born in Tampico, that's right, but I have to confess, very early age, moved and grew up in Dixon, Illinois, which is a few miles away and a little larger, was a city to me then, and still is a place very close and dear to my heart. You know, to speak to all of you tonight, I can't help but realize how important it is to me at least, that I should find the right things to say. By way of illustration, I've got to tell you about a young fellow in our business who had a fine voice, and even though he was successful in show business, he aspired to an operatic career. He saved his money and finally was able to study voice in Milan, Italy. And after several years' study, he received that highest honor that could come to any opera singer. He was invited to sing at La Scala, the very spiritual fountainhead of opera. They were doing Pagliacci, and he sang the beautiful aria Vesti la Giubba, and when he'd finished singing, the applause from the orchestra seats and the balconies and the galleries was so sustained and so thunderous that they couldn't continue the opera till he stepped back center stage and repeated the aria as an encore. And again, the same sustained thunderous applause, and again he sang Vesti la Giubba. And this went on till finally he motioned for quiet, and he tried to tell them what this meant to him, how great this welcome was, and how touched he was. But he said, I have sung Vesti la Giubba now 9 times. My voice is gone. I cannot do it again. And a voice from the balcony says, you'll do it till you get it right. But you know, if you don't mind a personal reference, I have been talking for a number of years and protesting the growth of government. And I've been expressing a concern lest the permanent structure of government should become so big as to be virtually beyond the control of Congress, and that this permanent structure of government would begin to take a hand in determining governmental policy. And during these years of speaking, which go back more than a decade, I've seen what I think is an interesting development. Several years ago, when I spoke in this way and suggested the danger in government control that was inherent in the many federal helpful hand proposals, I was usually met with vehement denials, and I would be editorially attacked at times that I was an alarmist and that no such thing as federal control was intended. And then in a few years, a subtle change took place, and the very same people were not denying federal control was intended, but they were asking, well, what's wrong with federal control? And today, I'm sure many of us have heard the question asked, well, are you afraid of your government? Well, if they want an answer, yes, I am. And I think all of us should be. This was the admonition of the founding fathers over and over again, that government, any government, tends to grow, to increase its power until eventually individual freedom is lost. Because the truth is that only government is capable of tyranny. And man has never lost his freedom to anyone except to a government. Now, I realize this is a controversial subject. I think the problem is nonpartisan. It crosses party lines. Of course, I think when you start to apologize for a controversial subject, everything's controversial. There was a man knocked on a door one day, and a small boy answered the door, and the man said, is your father home? And the boy said, no. And he says, your mother home? And the boy said, no. Kind of nonplussed, the man said, well, son, I'm your uncle on your father's side. And the kid said, well, you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're sure as hell on the wrong side. But I've often thought that this, we should be able, if we're men and women of goodwill, to discuss this problem without bitterness and without the application of labels. But because so much of government growth has been concerned with welfare problems, there's a tendency for many people to accuse those who oppose them of lacking humanity if they question the omnipotence of the welfare state. A former president, many years ago, a president rather undistinguished, actually, in history, because there was no great crisis during his time or his tenure of office to underline his name, revealed, though, that he had something of a gift of prophecy. This president said a revolution is taking place which will leave the people dependent on government. Finding markets will develop into fixing prices and finding employment. The next step will be to furnish markets and employment, or in default, pay a bounty or dole. Those who look with apprehension on these tendencies do not lack humanity, but are influenced by the belief that the result of such measures will be to deprive the people of character and liberty. Well, 100 years ago, England's Lord Macaulay wrote to an American friend about our republic, and he pointed out to this American that in the 5th century AD, ancient Rome was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns. And he said, in the mid-20th century, and I would think that that's the approximate period we're in, he said, your republic will be so plundered. But with this difference, Rome's barbarians came from without her borders. Yours will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions. Perhaps what he had in mind was what a very famous historian, Professor Alexander Fraser Tytler, meant when he said that democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. He said, democracy can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship. Now, the strange thing is, the professor wasn't talking about our country or our democracy. We were still colonials of Great Britain, and he was explaining what had destroyed the Athenian Republic some 2,000 years before. You and I live in a kind of schizophrenic world today. We live with unprecedented ease and prosperity, but somehow it's kind of hard to accept and enjoy this as if we're on a broad highway that's leading always onward and upward. Instead, I think we're troubled because there's a vague suspicion that what we're experiencing is the exhilaration of a toboggan slide, and we're not quite sure what's around the next bend. Next week, as we end the fiscal year, we must increase the debt limit for the 5th time in 4 years. Our gold supply is so diminished that the solvency of our currency is in danger. We're told now that we're going to receive coins that will no longer contain the silver content because we're unable to do that anymore. And you think back to the days of Henry VIII. He tried that. He substituted copper for silver. And the Englishman learned to rub the coin with his fingers to find out if the copper glow came through. And if it did, he didn't take that coin or give as much in return for that as he would for the one with the dull silver finish. The cost of living, particularly of foodstuffs, has reached an all-time high. And yet the farmer who produces those foodstuffs is receiving the lowest percentage of the market basket dollar that he has ever received in all man's history. We pretend that we're at peace, but a few Americans die each day. I don't know what they call the war, but I'm sure that it must be total war where they're concerned. We move toward a welfare state and an unprecedented federalization of American life. Subsidies proliferate and security becomes so all-important as to override self-reliance, self-respect, and even simple morality. Serious discussion by supposedly learned men is granted to the idea not only of helping those in need, but in actually divorcing income from work, with a central authority satisfying not only the needs but the wants of the people. Well, a great French philosopher, and again we go back 100 years, Alexis de Tocqueville, warned that such a government would, quote, cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform. And thus the will of man is not shattered but softened and guided until the nation is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which government is the shepherd. Well, at first hearing, I'm sure we're inclined to doubt that we're within even distant gunshot of such an alteration of our free and independent way. But I wonder if such complacency is justified. Freedom is very fragile, and mankind has known only a few moments in his entire history, and most of those moments, strangely enough, have been ours. But now our limited government with its decentralized powers is giving way to planners who've laid an increasingly heavy hand in every facet of our lives. Sometimes when I look at the work of these planners, I think that if all of them were laid end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion. Once, a moment ago, when it was reference was made to the fact that I had a degree in economics, I have to tell you, when I think of some of the economists in Washington who are suggesting the mixed economy as the road of the future, when I was taking economics, we had a definition for an economist. This was a fellow with a Phi Beta Kappa key at one end of his watch chain and no watch at the other end. Once we had a system of checks and balances in this country. Well, now we know where the checks are coming from, but somewhere along the line we've lost our balance. We have a Declaration of Independence, an immortal document. The world had never seen anything quite like it. It takes 300 words. Just recently, the federal government issued a ruling establishing the price of cabbage. It took 29,911 words. If we ever need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we'll stick with one sentence from the old. He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including the 6 most populous and our state of California. Hundreds of government corporations operate thousands of businesses in direct competition with privately owned business. To date, in so doing, these government-owned corporations have lost $81 billion. That's more than a fourth of the national debt. And hardly a recommendation for those among us who say that government should take an even greater hand in managing the nation's economy. Paperwork that government forces on private industry, it is estimated, costs the private American industry $20 billion a year. It's estimated it takes 35% of the working time of the average small businessman just to fill out government forms. The threat of even more regulation and outright takeover looms ever larger. How many of us are aware of some of the thinking, some of the things that are being said openly today in government? Robert Weaver, Federal Housing Administration, has stated publicly that while government a few years ago or some years ago had to turn over to the people the ownership of land in order to speed its development, he has said the goal of government today is to regain complete control of the use of the land. Louis Levine, director of the United States Employment Service, backed by a $200 million budget, says the ultimate goal of his agency is to make the United States Employment Service the manpower agency for the entire nation. That they disagree with the idea that any man should have to pay a fee to any agency in order to find employment. Every businessman could tell his own story of harassment. The natural gas producers have one I like to tell. Not too long ago, they were handed a 428-page questionnaire. It weighs 10 pounds. Each page is 2 feet long and has room for hundreds of entries. They have to fill it out in quadruplicate. One firm has estimated it'll take 17,000 accountant man hours to complete it. The Power Commission says it has to have it to determine whether they're charging the right price for gas. Are we safe in our books and our records? Not too long ago, the Postmaster General admitted that letters addressed to private citizens who are delinquent or back in their income tax have been turned over to the Internal Revenue Service for inspection. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over American farms, surveying from the air to check and see whether the farmer has violated his planting allotment. If he has, he's guilty as charged and has no day in court. He's fined, and if the fine isn't paid, his property is seized and sold at auction. Government involvement in the farm economy gives us a window on what happens when the government invades areas that are not its proper province. Now, in all the world, man is still faced with the inability to provide for himself, his loved ones, and perhaps even one or two of his neighbors not engaged in the production of food or fiber. But here in America, as no place else in the world, the American farmer has developed his craft to the point of genius. Here the farmer can feed not only himself and his family, but literally hundreds of his fellow human beings. But spurred on by the Depression, we set out to help needy farmers with a subsidy. And we end up giving 80% of the subsidy funds to the 1/4 of farms with the highest incomes. A year ago, a little better than that, the wheat farmers voted against the wheat program. And they found out you don't say no to Santa Claus. The government dumped surplus wheat in the market and broke the price. And then it passed the wheat program anyway and achieved something of a new high in bureaucratic ingenuity, because with that program it lowered the price of wheat to the farmer, increased the price of flour and bread to the consumer, reduced exports, and presented the taxpayer with a bill for $100 million. And now they're so proud and happy of what they've done that they're going to put the same kind of a program into effect for the rice farmer. I mentioned the taxpayer. That's someone who works for the government and doesn't have to take a civil service examination. For every dollar... For every dollar in the farm program that we were spending on price stabilization in 1948, we are today spending $25. And with what result? Well, 2 million farmers have been driven to the city in search of jobs. The farmer's debt in relation to income is greater than at any time in history, including the eve of the disastrous 1929 collapse. Today, the farmer owes $2.86 for every dollar of net income. We move on and we find that our traditional laws of eminent domain, laws that we always had to protect us because we recognized that now and then government would find it necessary to take private property, that it would need it for a fort, a road, a school, a public use of some kind. But the citizen was protected with a day in court, knowing that the government had to prove that there was a present need for this property, and then the price must be established as fair. But today, public need has become anything that a few government planners decide it should be. We've adopted an urban renewal program. The original intent was to provide quickly decent homes for every American to eliminate slums. Now, no one disagrees with that humanitarian purpose. But since 1949, there's been an overly costly program. It's been destructive of personal liberty and has failed to fulfill its original intent. In a 10-year period, urban renewal has destroyed 126,000 low-rent homes and replaced them with only 28,000 units at a higher rent. 750,000 people have been driven away by the bulldozer of urban renewal, and most of them have wound up in slums paying a higher rent. The law says the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But if standard housing at rents they could afford in convenient locations had been available, they'd have moved out into them a long time ago without waiting for an urban renewal program. And in the meantime, to show the contrast between public effort and what can be done at the private level by free enterprise, while those 28,000 high rent units were being built, private enterprise in the same period has built 27 million dwelling units. Now let me make it plain. I don't challenge the sincerity of these planners that I'm criticizing. I honestly mean this. I know that they have only humanitarian purpose. I know that they want to sincerely solve some of the problems that beset mankind because of poverty and the ills that have always bothered him. But when I look sometimes at their efforts at help, I think about a young fellow that was riding a motorcycle. It was a cold winter day and the wind was whistling through the buttonholes on his leather jacket and chilling him. Until he figured something out, he turned the jacket around and put it on backward. This solved the cold problem, but it kind of restricted his arm motion. And he hit a patch of ice and skidded into a tree. When the ambulance got there, the attendants elbowed their way through the crowd, and one of the attendants said to the bystanders, "What happened?" And the fellow said, "Well, we don't know. When we got here, he seemed to be all right, but by the time we got his head turned around straight, he was dead." Now the government urges upon us a new cabinet post of urban affairs. They have a program for subsidizing rents, and they've admitted that this program, if put into effect, first of all would require a means test in which the citizen would have to make available to the government his entire records, including his income. And they've admitted also that people of incomes up to $10,000 a year could perhaps be eligible for this rent subsidy, so that people could move up and live in homes and neighborhoods beyond their means, with their thrifty new neighbors subsidized to help pay their rent. Urban renewal plans, we're told, will, quote, be used in a new way so that all our tools, from poverty program to education and construction, can be used together to create meaningful and livable communities within our cities. And of course, again, the nation's capital will decide what is meaningful and what is livable. We have a poverty program. It was based on the case of the classic poverty pocket of all time. When they were trying to pass this program, I'm sure you will all recall that over and over again we heard that West Virginia was the center of world misery, that we must have a poverty program for no other reason than to solve the problems and the distress of West Virginia. Well, now we have the poverty program, and West Virginia is going to get $400,000. Texas is going to get $9 million. This is only a coincidence, of course. Like charity, though, in this program, I think it begins at home. And home, in their case, is their own bureaucratic headquarters. One area in Virginia, Gum Springs, Virginia, has just been awarded $74,000, $54,000 for administrative salaries and $20,000 for the poor. And the mayor of Paterson, New Jersey, is upset because he's just discovered that the administrator for the poverty program gets $1,000 a year more than he gets. We have a youth phase of the poverty program. They're going to salvage young people who fail to meet their responsibility in preparing themselves for adult life. Now again, no one quarrels with this goal. But while this salvage operation is going on, we're going to pay them in this program a higher rate of pay than we give the young man who puts on a uniform and stands in the defense of his country. And this is pretty ridiculous. Now the pattern follows in the dropout program. We have a retraining program, and in one area, we've discovered, of course, that one of the major causes of the dropout is the need to earn money while getting educated. In this particular area where this program has gone into effect, they've made the rate of pay for the dropout in the retraining program so much higher than the legitimate pay that the student can get who's working part-time that they've created an inducement, an incentive for the student to drop out because he can continue his education and get a raise in pay. I wonder if we no longer think that it's necessary to teach the simple virtues, or that reward is right for labor, or to repay when we borrow. Here in California, in a small college town, the Rotary Club has a fund of some thousands of dollars that for a number of years they've been lending to students in this small college. This is to be repaid, no interest, following graduation, after the student has established himself in an earning capacity. The other day, the dean of the college called the Rotary Club and said, if you're not willing to make this loan fund an outright gift, we won't need it anymore because the government is now providing the money and the students don't have to repay it. Samuel Gompers, the founder of the American Federation of Labor and a great humanitarian, said, doing for people what they can and ought to do for themselves is a dangerous experiment. In the last analysis, the welfare of the workers depends on his own initiative. Let social busybodies and professional morals experts in their fads reflect upon the perils they rashly invite under the pretense of social welfare. Some time ago, the newspapers you represent carried an item just a few weeks ago about a woman in Bloomington, Illinois. This woman has 6 children and she works in a laundry for approximately $50 a week. She's been deserted by her husband, but before the desertion, she gave him $164 for her share of their joint income tax return, and when he skipped with the money. The Internal Revenue Service isn't able to find him, but they could find her at the laundry. So they've moved in and levied against her salary, taking this money, which is the sole support for her 6 children, for $50 a week. Well, now, she's never asked for anything free before in her life. She was finally talked into seeing the Aid for Dependent Children program, and they were overjoyed to see her. And they figured out that they can arrange that she's entitled to $450 a month for doing nothing. The thing that put the item in the paper was not the fact that she now gets $450 a month. The fact is, she's refused that, and all she's holding out for is her $50 a week from the laundry, and this they don't understand at all, so they're going to investigate her. The network of rules grows more minute. Down on the Dixie line between the north and the south, there's an oil station operator. And he gets a lot of tourist trade, in the winter especially, from northern tourists going to the south. And that little triangle of ground that you usually find between the sidewalk and the driveway that's covered with gravel in most places, he planted a few cotton bushes. Pretty enterprising. He figured out when the tourists came in, he'd give them a souvenir, a cotton bowl picked off a cotton bush with their purchase of gas. You won't believe it, but he's just been fined by the federal government for planting cotton without an allotment. Now the government's going to subsidize art and literature. They tell us that the program will call for two czars at the federal level, empowered to grant millions of dollars each year on the basis of their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art and literature. And of course, they will determine what is meaningful. Now, I may be unduly perturbed, but if they follow the pattern that government-sponsored research has followed, there is some reason for concern. I don't set myself up as an authority on science. This was not a strong subject of mine in school. But sometimes I wonder if in our scientific research, the government isn't just subsidizing intellectual curiosity. When I see that we're spending tens of thousands of dollars on research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only thing I understand about that is the phrase "in the middle." There, I know who they're talking about. But now the nation's capital has gone even further. There's nothing that they will not be concerned about, including our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors, in recreational areas. There's a book by the Special Engineering Services Branch of Environmental Engineering and Food Protection of the United States Public Health Service. That isn't the book I read. That's the agency that's putting it out. The book is entitled Environmental Health Practices in Recreational Areas. It's 134 pages of profundities, and I wonder how we managed to get along without it up till now. For example, it gives us this pearl of wisdom. If you lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such a height that the drinking level is convenient for the persons using the fountain. But wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. It says insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. Well, I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But this isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that by ourselves. If exciting reading like that catches on, TV's going right out the window. Professor Teitler's loose fiscal policy may well be at hand. Our government is spending $260 million a day. That's $10 million a day more than we were spending just 1 year ago. Our government is responsible for a deliberate, planned inflation. It has reduced in less than three decades the purchasing price of the dollar to 35.5 cents. In the last 20 years, it has eroded the value of our savings and our insurance and our bonds by $190 billion. When I was a boy back in Illinois, I heard my father often say what the country needed was a good 5 cent cigar. What this country needs is a good 5 cent nickel. Government practices bookkeeping tricks that would jail a private citizen. We're told that the budget is still under $100 billion. Last year, there was great talk of economy. We're told that the budget was $98 billion. But $10 billion was in obligational spending authority, hidden and not shown in the budget, hidden by these bookkeeping tricks. Now we're told the budget is $99.7 billion. And again, on page 13 of the budget message, they ask for obligational spending authority of $106.4 billion. And now, Congress, as I said before, has been asked to raise the debt limit for the fifth time in 4 years. And the interest on that debt takes $22,000 a minute, every minute of every hour of the 24, day in and day out. These bookkeeping tricks have reached a new high in sophistication. The Medicare bill is presented as costing each citizen only a few cents each month. And that's true. It will be true when it's passed, until after the 1968 election. And then we're going to discover, just as we discovered last April, that there was a catch in the so-called tax reduction. Because following 1968, The particular bill is going to go up for the Social Security and Medicare bill to about $500 a year for the average citizen. With our gold supply down from 70% of the world's supply to one-third, since foreign aid started in 1948, we continue a program in which the ink spattered on American embassies in Hate America campaigns is bought by American taxpayers. And we go along with the hypocrisy. Our State Department pretends that there could be such a thing as a spontaneous uprising in a police state. And so we send a dignified note demanding that the next time they send more police. I think we'd have more self-respect if our State Department would send them a note and tell them to send a smaller mob the next time. 325,000 dependents of civilian employees, not military, civilian employees are living abroad, adding to the deficit in our exchange and the outflow of our gold. But businessmen are asked to do a 180-degree turn, forsake our traditional role of trading in the world's marketplace. I say they're asked, but you and I know, or at least we have an uncomfortable feeling that they're told, do it or else. We're taxed on our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the productive free economy than any society has ever done without ruin. Now we are told we're going to have a $5 billion cut in excise taxes, but we're also going to have a $5 billion deficit, and we won't really be taxed less. They're just going to rearrange it and apply it somewhere else. They pretend on a theory that we can rob Peter to pay Paul, on the idea that Peter is loaded. Well, no one's loaded any longer, and we'd better wake up that we're robbing Paul to pay Paul. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can cut taxes without cutting the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. Government's like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. In an atmosphere of emergency now, we're being told that the federal government can help us with our school problems. They claim they'll exercise no federal control. But when competent educators went to Washington and protested, there is no emergency that cannot be met at the state and local level, and proposed a plan whereby the local districts could receive more money without creating a new federal bureaucracy or agents. The Freudian slip occurs, and Francis Keppel, the United States Education Commissioner, in his debate with these noted educators, said that under their plan, the reason the government couldn't go along with it was because they couldn't achieve their social objectives. Well, if the government's going to build the schools and buy the books and grant scholarships and make judgments and exert pressure, you and I'd better ask what happens if someday that pressure is of a political nature not to our liking. Education is the bulwark of freedom, but when you remove it too far from the parents and the community control, it becomes a tool of tyranny. Now, may I bring it a little closer to home? I doubt that I could speak to any audience, with the exception of a convention of outdoor advertisers, and get any disagreement with the idea that all of us would prefer that our highways be scenic delights unmarred by billboards. So very few voices have yet been raised in protest over the government's announced intention to beautify our countryside by removing those eyesores. But I think you and I should take a closer look at this. We live in a society where precedent, once established, determines the future course. Now, these billboards are on private property. No suggestion has been made that the government seek voluntary removal or compensate the property owners for the loss of revenue. Nor did the government make this a part of the deal when they purchased rights of way for highways from private property owners, as they can, and I think should do, when they buy future rights of way. This would make sense and be within keeping or within the scope of our free enterprise system if in buying a highway right of way, they compensated on a basis that there would never be erected or sold space for highway advertising. But if they follow through in the present suggestion, and if you and I give in to the idea that government now has the right to simply come in and cancel this out, what if someday the government decides it doesn't like a structure? What if it decides it doesn't like the home or the barn or the building, something that the farmer has erected or the property owner on his own property? Haven't we actually established a precedent that government has that right? I'm sure that you, of all people, know very well without my reminding you that during the Korean War, there was serious talk of a tax on advertising, not for the purpose of raising revenue. They were very frank that they wanted to make advertising so costly as to reduce the advertising and thus reduce the public impulse to buy. And thus, they said, there will be more money left with little protest for the government to take it through taxation to finance the war. Now, you and I could start faulting this one, and we'd run into each other along the line with the reasons why it's a zany pipe dream and would be completely contrary to everything that we represent. But the adherents were serious. You and I know that the free exchange of ideas is our weapon against tyranny. And you and I know that the economics of advertising makes such a free exchange of ideas possible in this complex society. What we have to ask ourselves is, do we wait until the fire reaches our door before we start fighting back? Or do we join the others today that now have similar problems, similar infringements upon their freedom? If we're so short-sighted as to believe that we can stand by until actually the threat reaches our door, then we're as short-sighted as a fellow going into the poultry business without a rooster. We're putting a hell of a lot of confidence in the stork. You know, freedom is not spelled with an S. Freedom is indivisible. You can't elect to be partly free, to give up some freedoms and retain others. As a matter of fact, with apologies to your chairman, Les Benson, you could well adopt a slogan that freedom is spelled with an A, and A is for advertising. Daniel Webster said, nothing will ruin the country if the people themselves will undertake its safety, and nothing can save it if they leave that safety in any hands but their own. You and I have to determine, regardless of our occupation, that the doctor's fight against socialized medicine is our fight. If you can socialize the doctor, you can socialize the patient. We have to recognize that government's assault on investor-owned utilities is eventually an assault upon our own business. We have to demand an end to deficit spending, because we're faced with an evil enemy, and there can be no security anywhere in the free world if there isn't economic stability within the United States. In all of history, every time a cultured or advanced society has been faced by the poorer, less cultured, the barbarians have triumphed. You and I must determine whether man is born with certain unalienable rights, or whether he exists only by permission of and for the sake of the group. If we accept the collectivist high-sounding phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number, then we're actually admitting that we have a system that is no longer based on government defending the right of the individual. We're then agreeing on mob rule. We're agreeing that 50% of the people plus one can do anything they choose and impose anything they choose on the rest of the people simply because they outnumber them. And once we agree to that, then we march toward eternity as soulless freaks of nature in a super ant heap. Either the power of society is limited or it's not, and we can't have it both ways. Probably the greatest danger facing any of us today is the tendency on the part of so many of us to believe that this isn't our fight, and that actually we shouldn't do anything about it because we have to fear reprisal. Reprisal from customers or clients who disagree with us, or even reprisal in this day and age from the pressure of government. But we can't afford that. We've reached a point that if you follow that policy today, you're just feeding the crocodile, hoping he'll eat you last. But eat you he will. We've come to a moment of truth. We have to ask whether we've grown soft. We lighted a torch 200 years ago that said to the world's downtrodden that here at last, men had banded together, pledging their collective strength to guarantee the freedom and the dignity of even the least individual among them. If we let that torch go out, the darkness will destroy the golden hope of mankind for generations to come. If ours is to be the generation that fails, then let's at least fail in such a way that our children and our children's children will say of us that in our brief moment here, we did all that could be done. If we do any less than that, then I think we'd better begin planning right now what we're going to tell those children it was that we found more precious than freedom, because they'll have a right to know. Thank you.
trying to find out when the snow flies in the Sierras.
Okay. That's the answer. A reminder now, the zoo bus is another announcement we didn't make. That's tomorrow morning.